You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, April 26, 2016. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, ladies and gentlemen, Thomas Frank, author of Listen Liberal, or Whatever Happened to the Party of the People. He's the best-selling author of What's the Matter with Kansas. Ladies and gentlemen, we're on vacation right now, but your brain's not on vacation. And our feeding of your brain is not on vacation. It's barely a vacation at all. Just we're just not here in person, but does that mean that you're not going to get the same quality show that you normally get? No, it means that you are going to get the same quality show that you normally get. This is a vacation? My God, this show is amazing. Even more amazing, with the coupon code MRSPRING16, you get 30% off of JustCoffee.coop. There's only a couple of days left, folks. Go order it now. Pause your podcast. Go to justcoffee.coop. Use the coupon code MRSPRING16, 30% off of fair trade coffee. You know you've always wanted to try it. Now's your chance. So, ladies and gentlemen, we're on vacation. Conversation I had with Thomas Frank. In a long time coming. His book, Listen Liberal, is out. I think you're really going to enjoy this conversation. This is a nice piece that goes along with the Meg Jacobs interview that we have at the end of the week about the panic at the pump. I mean, one is about the 70s and how energy is a pivot point for a lot of different ideologies. But we both, Frank and I, we hearken back to this period as he talks about what happened to liberals. And you could also listen to Thomas Frank, Panic at the Pump. If you run out of stuff this week, I don't know how you could. We're giving you so much content. But then go back and listen to the Lily Geismer interviews that we have done, which also look at another this time period. Then Rick Perlstein. My God, you could go down a wormhole with this show. But enjoy this interview with Thomas Frank. We have more interviews for you for the rest of the week. It's as if we are not on vacation. In fact, we doubled up working. Matt's here all night. Matt, are you even going to go home tonight? Are you going to, like, Matt has a cot in the studio. He's just going to be here all night cutting this stuff up and picking out deep archive stuff.
Yeah, we got an okay couch here.
There you go. There you go, ladies and gentlemen. And why not help us get some throw pillows for that couch so that Matt doesn't have a crick in his neck? You can become a member of the Majority Report today by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. Jointhemajorityreport.com. We rely on memberships to really make this show run. It is true. Our ads, theoretically, with ads, we could get a couple of throw pillows. But you can support the show that way. Obviously, justcoffee.coop. And if you buy crap from Amazon or from Jet.com, go to MajorityReportKickback.com, click on either one of those links, Jet.com is fantastic. You get 15% off your first purchase. Bookmark them and always buy your Jet.com stuff or your Amazon stuff through there, and we get a kickback. All right, here's Thomas Frank for you free beers. And for you members, stick around. We got a Matt pick from the deep archive. Okay, here's Thomas Frank. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome Thomas Frank. He is, of course, the best-selling author of What's the Matter with Kansas? Here with his new book, Listen Liberal, or Whatever Happened to the Party of the People. Tom, welcome back to the program.
Sam, it's great to be here.
All right. So the subject of your latest book is looking at the Democratic Party's failure to be what I guess the Democratic Party maybe says they've been and what people anticipate or expect the Democratic Party to be. Is that fair?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, the party of the people. You know, the party of working people, of the middle class, which is it's their brand identity. I mean, that's who we have thought they are for a very long time.
And so let's trace back as to how this shifted, because you know, you and I spoke for Ring of Fire a couple of weeks ago, and you obviously in your book are citing some of the work done by Lily Geismer, who has been on this program. Her book, Don't Blame Us.
I've got a copy of it right here on my bookshelf. I'm actually looking at it at this very moment.
Suburban Liberals and the Transformation of the Democratic Party outlines and actually uses Massachusetts just about 45 minutes from me as sort of the test case or sort of the example that illustrates the dynamic of how the Democratic Party basically switched who they wanted to be their primary constituency. Tell us about that.
Yeah, and that's what she is describing is back in the 1970s. And that's an important part of the story in Listen Liberal, but I bring it up to the present. Basically the book starts with a question, which is you've got this party that, you know, it's the left party in the system. As we said, we've always thought they're the party of the middle class, the working people of America. And look at this. Inequality grows and grows and grows. What's going on here? How come this party is, you know, seems to be, and this is with Barack Obama in the White House, a man who we are assured all the time is the most liberal possible president, if not an outright communist. You know, and here inequality gets worse and worse and worse. What's going on? And the answer that I came up with is that the Democratic Party isn't who we think it is, and that they serve a very different the constituency they really care about is not the working class, but professionals, sort of high achieving white collar group of people, you know, very affluent people. And the book about Massachusetts in the 70s traces this transformation at the very beginning. This transformation, by the way, was much commented upon in the 1970s, but then was pretty much forgotten. So there's this moment in the 1970s where the Democrats basically removed organized labor from its structural role in the Democratic Party in the early 1970s.
That actually happened. That actually happened. Like McGovern actually did that on the Rules Committee in '68, right? I mean, this was a reaction.
That's when it began. And between '68 and '72, they had this thing called the McGovern Commission, chaired by George McGovern, who would later be the party's nominee for president. And that's what did it. They reformed how the party operated, and that's where this whole thing began. What's funny is this all happened out in the open. And Democrats, I mean, they were very open about what they were doing. They were even proud of it. They wrote books about it, that blue collar people were no longer progressive. The big breaking point here was the Vietnam War. The party was fighting with itself over the Vietnam War, And professionals are traditionally are you know characteristically very liberal on a range of issues, and that included the Vietnam War. And this seemed like a reasonable move at the time. You know, labor looked pretty bad. Organized labor looked bad in the early 70s. It was big dinosaur organizations, very slow moving. A lot of them were really undemocratic, a lot of the big unions.
There was a healthy dose of racism, right? And
yep, they were very white.
And reluctance for both the sort of black emancipation movements and women emancipation movements.
Well, I mean, let's not go too far. The main sin was they supported Johnson on the Vietnam War. But they also had been instrumental in the civil rights movement. I mean, so labor is, you know, their problems were pretty well known at the time. But they didn't look like progressive organizations anymore. Now, it's a funny moment in history, because you know when you this is the high point of equality in America in the early 1970s. You know, the country, working class people are doing pretty well, you know, and so it probably never occurred to anyone at the time that when they made this move that they were setting us up for what has come to pass 40 years later, you know. But the obvious thing to me is when you remove working people's organizations, no matter how corrupt or how, you know, degraded these organizations are. And they were at a low point back then. They've improved quite a bit since then. But when you do that, you also remove working people's issues from the, you know, from the party. And that they didn't seem to anticipate. They didn't really understand that. And because it probably didn't make much of a difference back then.
Right. I mean,
now it's enormous.
I mean, the irony too, though, is that, like, you know, and we're going to obviously talk about, you know, there's going to be this contrasting to where Democrats are now versus, let's say, FDR. One of the things we do know about the New Deal was that it really did. It was a New Deal, but not necessarily for everybody. I mean, it specifically had to carve out exceptions. I mean, not explicitly exceptions, I think, but industries and jobs and that were heavily populated by African Americans and women.
Well,
got
especially in the South, you know, like sharecroppers and stuff like that. That's
when,
right.
And home health care workers. And I mean, and so you 40 years later, 30 years later or some odd, you have this sort of a sea change in American politics where there are these emancipation movements. And it's true. I think the leadership was definitely there on civil rights, but not necessarily. It depended on what union, it seems to me. And it also not necessarily was shared by its rank and file, right? Because a lot of these guys, and I do mean guys, end up being the so-called Reagan Democrats 12 years later.
Oh, that's right. That's right. But later. That's later on down the road.
Right.
But the problem is that there's also a stereotype here. It's, you know, the Archie Bunker stereotype. And you've got to be, I think you have to be careful and not dismiss, you know, union members and working class people in that way. I mean, yes, some of these people, of course, were pretty bad. But the main thing that really did it, if you read the literature
the
at the time, was Vietnam.
Okay,
that was the issue that really tore these guys apart.
So that cleaves the
long
party.
Long story short. So here we are 40 years later, and what you see in this intervening period is this succession of democratic reform movements all through the 70s and 80s and 90s, and they all agree on one thing. You know, this is like the Democratic Leadership Council, who you're familiar with, or the new what were they called? The neoliberals was another movement. You know, all of these different movements, and they were all. You know, they disagreed on all sorts of things, but they all agreed that the Democrats could no longer be the party of the New Deal. They could no longer be the party of workers. Who they needed to be was the party I take that back. The Democratic Leadership Council used to present itself as the voice of forgotten what they called forgotten Democrats, meaning these blue-collar voters. But the issues that they cared about were, of course, lobbyist issues. It was always like, you know, more free trade treaties and stuff like that. You remember these guys.
And austerity. Yeah, sure. And Bill Clinton was their first president.
He was their leader. That's right, for a period. That's how he got started on his run for the presidency.
And what I've come to understand too, you know, and you know, as a kid growing up in Massachusetts, I was, you know, I thought Michael Dukakis was fantastic and was going to beat George Herbert Walker Bush. Now this is 1988 at this point, but there was this school of thought coming out of Massachusetts of this sort of like technocratic, somewhat conservative, almost quite austerity, but getting there.
But technocracy, that's the key word when you're talking about Dukakis. And also when you're talking about someone like Obama or even someone like Bill Clinton, is the idea that the right experts seated behind the controls in Washington, D.C. can solve any problem. And the funny thing is, I believe in government by experts. I think experts should be running things, you know. But this is a philosophy of it that you know, repeatedly gets these questions wrong, repeatedly gets outplayed by the Republicans, and ultimately, and this is the point that really is fascinating to me, ultimately sees itself as a class vehicle of the technocrats themselves. They start acting in their own interest, and this might sound really strange. Let me put it in a different way. What happened was, as the Democrats pitched working people out of their coalition, they decided that they were in love with a different group, and that was, I mentioned before, the sort of affluent white-collar professionals, okay? And so this group is, you know, very well represented in Democratic Party councils, and this is in their demographic, I mean, in their the people who support them in their coalition, and also the Democratic politicians themselves. And these people basically act in their own class interest. They legislate in their own class interest, and they are singularly unconcerned with issues of income inequality. That is just not an issue for them. Nothing having to do with like the fate of working people is of any interest to them. They're completely on the other side on those issues. They can be very liberal on social issues, really good liberals on all sorts of issues. But on anything having to do with income inequality, they're not there.
I want to try and like sort of just dig into this a little bit, because I mean, it seems to me, and maybe this is, you know, we have crossed some type of threshold, and I want to get there. I don't want to get too ahead of ourselves. But when you're looking at this sort of cohort that the Democratic Party over the course of the 70s, the 80s, and I think culminating with Bill Clinton decides to represent, because maybe that's where they see the votes are, that's where they see the sort of the trends in terms of where people are moving, and the Democrats feel they have this is almost sort of like a this is sort of like a flanking maneuver in some way, they're moving into what was traditional Republican territory in some way, and going to the suburbs. They're getting the sort of outer ring, I guess, of so-called liberalism with things like all right on the environment, all right on issues of emancipation and of affirmative action, and in terms of ERA.
They're very good on issues having to do with equality of opportunity. Okay, removing barriers to to whether it's race or gender, you know, barriers to entry to anything, right? To college, to the professions, to any kind of jobs. That sort of thing they're very good at.
They'll support things by, I just want to just, you know, tease that out. So barrier of entry. So they will support a mechanism that will allow you to go to college, but not necessarily.
Everybody gets to fill out an application to Harvard.
Oh, but aren't loans part of that too? I mean, isn't sort of this strain of neoliberalism is that there's a market solution for all of this, and we'll make sure that there is a market solution here as opposed to.
We'll fiddle with the dials a little bit. And that's you've just described Obamacare, you know, or you've just described so many of their great initiatives of the Democratic Party. We'll fiddle with the dials a little bit, and we'll devise a market-based solution to these things. And we won't upset, you know, everybody, nobody will get their suit ruffled, you know, everybody will be intact. We don't have to do anything that'll hurt the insurance companies, or we don't have to do anything that'll hurt the big banks. You know, everything is going to work out fine. Everybody's going to be fine.
We can cut middle-class taxes because we're no longer creating universality. Universality is no longer the issue. Because my sense is that this cohort is also like okay with a safety net, but the safety net has to be like, you know, in the case of an emergency, break this glass type of safety net, as opposed to maintaining the living standards of the wide, you know, of the working class, largely speaking,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Now you brought up a really important point here, which is education. The kind of liberals that I'm describing, and listen, liberal, when they see an economic problem, they automatically do this kind of mental operation where they translate it into an educational problem. There's an educational solution, I should say, to every economic problem. And so you start talking about income inequality, and they start talking about student loans. You know, we need to hand out more student loans. Or they start talking about charter schools or something like that. For them, every problem is a problem of education. And this is – it's an interesting reflex that they have. But ultimately, at the bottom, what it is saying is that the blame goes back to the individual. If
right.
you're not getting ahead in this economy – it's because you weren't you somehow missed the boat at school. Somehow you screwed up at school, or you didn't get the right opportunity to get a better education or something like that. But it always comes back to the individual going to school. It's funny because it parallels a lot of Republican arguments. Republicans project all this into, you know, starting your own business and becoming an entrepreneur, and Democrats project it all onto how you did at school. Which is typical of the professional class. The professional class is, of course, defined by their achievements in school. That's where all the professions come from.
Isn't that the impetus for that, to focus on education? Isn't that a way of saying the function or the structure of society is okay? We've just got to make sure that we're dealing with the inputs correctly. And therefore,
yeah,
we'll
right.
get good outputs. And that basically protects the structure of the system and says that we don't really need any structural reform. We just need to make sure that we're, like you say, providing the opportunity, because the avenue is there. We just got to make sure that everybody has an on-ramp onto that avenue.
Exactly. So you go into an impoverished part of America and you make sure that all the smart kids there get to go to a good college.
Right.
And that's it. That's your answer to the problem. The idea that something like organized labor represents, which is that no, working class people in general are entitled to a middle class way of life. That they should have that they should be able to achieve that, even if they didn't go to college. For your average, you know, the kind of Democrat I'm describing, that is as alien as it is to a Republican, as it is to someone like George W. Bush. That is as foreign an idea, you know, completely incomprehensible.
All right, so let's go through the history of this. I mean, obviously, the two big eras, or there's three presidents, right, in this era of new Democratic.
Well, yes, there's Carter, Clinton, and Obama. And Carter, I see, as kind of a transitional figure. You know, the Democrats aren't quite there yet. All the pieces aren't in place. It hasn't really clicked together as an ideology, but it comes really into full flower with Bill Clinton. You know, if you go back and read by the way, so I should describe how I did my research for this book. It's I did not use any of the kind of conservative Clinton bashing literature. I didn't read any of that. I didn't go there at all. I didn't read, like, you know, or the same with Obama. I did not use any of that sort of critique. You know, they think that these guys are Satan, right? They're just like absolutely demonic. They think that they killed people and stuff like that.
We are well versed with the Park,
yeah,
Vince Foster, and but isn't part of the reason why they were so angry at Clinton? It seems to me there were two reasons. One is that he came in and I remember on day one, Rush Limbaugh was talking and they had already made pins impeach Clinton because of, I mean, to, you know, it's hard to know, you know, how they generate, you know, where the hate comes from in a bunch of different ways. But A, he won 45% and became president,
yeah.
His first run through, which is a pretty rare occurrence, I think, in American politics.
Right.
And B, you know, there was all the stuff like they saw him as some type of philanderer. And I think they also hated Hillary Clinton because she was pretty out, at least early on in the campaign, you know, out and out is like, I'm a partner and I'm not going to bake cookies in the kitchen.
No, they that's really right, that's right.
But wasn't it also part of it is that he had left them very little sort of, at least in terms of the non-crazy arenas of politics, he had left them very little room. Like he had planted his flag, it seems to me. I mean, he's talked some populism during that campaign.
He did. The campaign was kind of interesting in 92 because he ran as a kind of populist. There, you know, by the way, inequality is not a new issue. People were talking about it in 1992. It was a big deal. They didn't use that word. There was no like Thomas Piketty thing, but there were best-selling books on the subject. And it was, you know, we were in the middle of a bad recession.
Mm-hmm.
George H.W. Bush was president and, Clinton ran as a kind of old school, populist. That's how he got elected. Once in office, he completely changed course. So the right-wing hatred for him is fascinating to me as well. I don't really go into it in this book, but I've often tried to understand it. And, you know, every now and then you'll see it completely break down. Like right now, we're arguing over the 1994 crime bill again. And you'll see, like, the Wall Street Journal has come out in defense of Bill Clinton. And this is a man that they – oh, my God, they hated him so much. Remember, they were the ones that were running those editorials, like, who is Vince Foster? You know, do you remember this?
Oh, yeah,
they did this whole series of things. And the Whitewater scandal, they thought this was such a big deal. Now they're defending him.
Well, they're going to be doing the same thing when they attack either Hillary or Bernie. In 6 years, they're going to be talking about wistfully about the days where Barack Obama was bringing reason to.
Yes, they are. Right. That's exactly right. Because you know why? Because they are playing the game, and they were playing the game at the time, and they're still playing the game today. And what I mean by that is their object was constantly to drive Clinton further to the right. It didn't matter what he said or what he did. They always just keep moving the goalpost further right. By the way, so the 94 crime bill plays an important part in my book, in Listen Liberal. And what's interesting is when you go back and look at it, I mean, I scarcely remember the debate over the crime bill at all, except for one thing, midnight basketball. Do you remember that?
Yes, I do.
That's all they talked about. Yep. And that was Rush Limbaugh. And they talked about it all the time as though the crime bill, and this is one of the most draconian, you know, crime bills ever, as though it was some kind of handout.
Right.
Poor
it was
people.
Just like they're just setting up like community basketball leagues. And that's what they're going to how they're going to fight with crime.
Right. Yeah. That's right. They zeroed in on that one part of it. And that's all they talked about.
Yep.
It's crazy. Anyhow, we're getting off the subject here. The thing is, I didn't use any of that literature. I read books by Clinton. Fans and by his, you know, straight journalistic and academic biographers. So none of the right-wing literature. I tried to work with the stuff that was written by people who admired him. And even so, I mean, his administration, from an inequality standpoint, his administration looks awful, just plain awful. You know, there were five things he did that his admirers were proud of. Do you remember? Do you want me to list them?
Let me see if I can guess. Crime bill, the welfare reform. I'm going to say the Telecommunications Act, although I don't know if that's actually in there. It's just something I hate.
That's right. You got three of them.
I would say the Commodities Future Modernization Act. And
yeah, but I group that. These are all deregulation. That's all deregulation.
Okay, deregulation. And the last one.
Now you missed NAFTA.
NAFTA.
They were so excited about NAFTA. They were so pumped about that. And he balanced the budget.
All right.
Those were his five great things. So the budget, NAFTA, the crime bill, welfare reform, and deregulation. And his admirers loved these things. This is why they thought he was a great president. Every single one of them, with the partial exception of balancing the budget, every single one of them has ended in disaster. Just complete thudding, you know, disaster.
And you know, I mean, I think people know the story of that, because I want to get up, because one of the things that sort of fascinates me about this is, like, because I remember in 92 when Bill Clinton was elected, I know exactly where I was. I was sitting in a comedy club in San Francisco, and everybody was so excited just to get.
Oh my God. I went to a party with Mayor Daley was at the party. I lived in Chicago at the time. Mayor Daley was at the party. We were so happy.
But I remember sitting there going, like, why are people so, I mean, I'm happy to get this, but I was very skeptical at the time. And yeah, it seems to me that, like, that we had that same dynamic with Obama. And I have to admit that I was, you know, I got swept up in the Obama stuff by the time the inauguration came around, far more so certainly than I was with Clinton. But that there was just not an awareness, it seems to me, in the Democratic Party of just sort of what the implications of this. I mean, there's a lot of obviously different moving parts here. And I have to say that, like, for years I contended we may have been better off with a second Bush administration, just because, well, I mean, people forget.
He would have never gotten NAFTA through Congress, never in a million years.
He would have never gotten NAFTA through Congress.
None of the things I just mentioned would have happened, because the Democrats would have fought to the – Democrats still had Congress. They would have fought to the end to stop those things.
And Poppy Bush was no George W. Bush. And Poppy Bush was, you know, I think – you know, at that time, his policies were fairly, you know, he was at heart a liberal Republican. The reason why he lost is because the Reagan fans knew this. They did not like him.
That's right.
And we were in a position where it seems to me when the wall falls and everybody's talking about the new world order, that to be in the position of basically redefining what that new world order would be, and less grander terms, you know, like what it's going to mean for this country, like where are we going to put our resources? We were talking about like a Cold War, you know, bonus or something that it was end up.
The peace dividend.
Yes, and it seems to me that the DLC was there. They had prepared for that moment. They came in and they reoriented this country when we did not have that ballast of communism, right? It was no longer like we've got to worry about that flank. It was almost as like now we can just sort of shift and just largely speaking, that's the only election I can think of where I think like we might have, our trajectory might have been better if we had had a George Herbert Walker Bush in there at that time.
Well, you mentioned an important piece of context here, which is the end of the Cold War. You could not do something like welfare reform while the Cold War was still on. I mean, by definition, what the Cold War was a competition between us and communism for the hearts and minds of the Third World. And part of that is that you have to prove that you care about the less fortunate in your society.
Indeed.
Well, you can't go winning the hearts and minds of anybody when you do something like that, you know, welfare reform or any of the things that I mentioned, you know, NAFTA, which just deindustrialized, or the NAFTA and the, if you group it together with all the other free trade agreements that we got under Clinton and then under George W.
There was a triumphalism.
I mean, deindustrialized the country.
There was a triumphalism, and it seemed like to a large extent, we had forgotten what happens, the victory of capitalism over communism. We had forgotten that, hey, you know, there was a reason why we had sort of structural reforms that made a mixed economy, if you will, or why we realized there were excesses of capitalism, but that was all sort of thrown out the window when the sort of the ballast, the party that sort of provided that, hey, you know, let's drink a little water with all this booze that we're sucking down tonight at this party. You know,
That's one way to look at it. Can I give you another the way that I like to look at it in the book? I call it Clintonism. So, Clint, like, you know, we used to talk about Thatcherism and stuff like that. But I think Clinton deserves an ism. And what I mean by Clintonism is it's basically when social class comes back into the Democratic worldview, but it's the opposite of the way the Democrats have always looked at social class. So it's the opposite of, like, you know, the Harry Truman, Lyndon Johnson, Franklin Roosevelt, you know, defenders of the middle class kind of thing. What Clinton does is he treats different kinds of Americans very differently. So people at the bottom get all of these measures to enforce discipline, okay, workplace discipline. You know, so welfare reform, you know, pushing people into the workforce, NAFTA, basically taking away working people's power to confront management, because, you know, management now has the ultimate weapon in their armory, right? They can always just in their back pocket, you know, they can always just say, well, we'll move the plant to Mexico, you know, if you don't give in on every last little thing. So he's giving them all of these, and then of course the crime bill, which is discipline, and it's, you know, that's what it is. And at the very same time, and this is what blows my mind, at the very same time that Clinton is doing these things, he's also literally rolling back the rules for Wall Street and the telecoms. He's actually removing the rules. They're not going to have law enforcement anymore.
Right.
So some people are getting this incredible crackdown, and other people are getting, you know, complete freedom to do as they want. Just fill your pockets, guys. Step up and fill your pockets. He bailed out a hedge fund, for God's sakes.
But isn't that...
Nobody remembers that one, by the way.
Right, that was a home...
Long-term capital management.
Right.
You remember this?
Yes.
And they bailed out Mexico, too. Mexico had been issuing these... had been really engaging in some iffy financial, issuing some bonds that were really questionable, but they had been very popular with American banks, with the investment banks in America, and so we bailed them out so that the government in Mexico would stay strong, and NAFTA wouldn't look bad, and all this sort of thing.
But Thomas, let me ask you,
that was the beginning of their courtship of Wall Street.
Do you think, in their mind, I mean, it seems to me that it's that you know, when you describe that, you know, the welfare reform is obviously like, you know, we're gonna, you know, there's a lot of finger wagging. I'm almost in my head, I actually see Bill Clinton just from the other day when he was confronted by some protesters. There's a lot
of
finger wagging.
He was literally wagging his finger at those people. Remember?
Yes, in the welfare reform is like that. Like, you got to work. This is the same thing of like this conservative ideology that Paul Ryan will talk about, and, you know, I know he's apologized, but I don't believe him. But the whole make or taker thing, and the whole thing about this whole thing about, like, you know, if you're poor, it is because you don't have the moral self-discipline, and we're going to impose it upon you. But the idea of the deregulation of the banks is not because he's saying, you guys go run hog wild. It's that I trust you, because we're basically in the same social circle. I trust your judgment, though I know that you won't go do that. And then when they do, just like, you know, a parent who refuses to believe the truth about their child, or, you know, the way you judge your buddy as opposed to someone who's, you know, you're across the street from you, is that there are extraneous circumstances as to what happened here. It wasn't their fault. It was, you know,
that's right.
The perfect
storm. They need a
bailout.
They need some understanding.
Exactly.
So you've just nailed the point of the book, which is that when this new species of Democrat that I'm describing, drawn from this very particular social class, this social stratum that is defined by educational achievement, Bill Clinton and Barack Obama are both perfect examples of it, and Hillary as well. And they look at Wall Street and they see their peers, they see their classmates, they see people just like them, very sophisticated thinkers who can write these you know, complex derivatives. You know, these are not people that you punish. These are not people that you discipline. These are people that you extend your understanding to.
These are the adults. Right. I mean, they look at them. I had a conversation with a guy who was at one point a fairly prominent politician years ago, 2012, I think it was. And I was asking him, like, maybe it was 2010 even. How can you explain Obama listening to these, these Reubenites and these bankers in terms of the way forward? And he says, look, he doesn't, he thinks they know what they're talking about. And he said to me, he says, I went to school with these guys. I know. Did he really
use that term? That's amazing.
No. He said, I went to school with these guys. I know they cheated and that they were C students and they cheated at tennis. That's what he said to me. And he says, Obama looks at these guys and thinks they know what they're doing.
You nailed it there. That is exactly right. That is exactly what's going on. It's this sort of basic class solidarity at the top. And, you know, zero understanding for people a little bit lower down. By the way, then there's all sorts of complexities to this story because, you know, we're watching this country is coming apart, you know, outside of the prosperous big cities and a handful of prosperous places that have done well. You know, this sort of Appalachification is going on. You read about it in the paper every day, you know, the OxyContin epidemics or the the
heroin problems,
themselves with alcoholism, and you know the deindustrialization, and all of these things. This is happening everywhere, but it's also happening to people who are doing everything right and doing as the president says, and they go to college and they get into a good school and they spend $65,000 a year to go to that good school, and they have to borrow it, but they do it because they know that's the only way to get ahead because the president says so, and. Well, it's not just the president. Of course, their principal says so. Their parents say so. Everybody tells them so. And these people are – there's a whole generation of these kids now, and they're ruined. You know, they're starting out life with a mortgage and no house.
That's right.
You know, $100,000 in debt.
And the thing is that's really – what it used to be was a ticket to ride, and now what it is, it's basically we're giving you a lottery ticket. And that means that you move into the next realm of people who may actually, succeed. You're completely shut out. And like you said, there's one cohort in the country, in fact, in the world, I think, more or less, that is seeing their life expectancy decline, and it's white males without a college education. They're actually living shorter lifespans as a function.
Well, they're bumping themselves off at this,
exactly.
at this record pace.
Yep.
It's shocking what's going on out there in the country, and it's also shocking to me that our leaders in Washington, many of them Democrats, just sort of wring their hands and say, oh, you know, there's nothing we can do. It's so sad, but, you know, there's nothing we can do. There's all sorts of things they can do. This is, you know, inequality. I'm sort of skipping ahead to Obama now.
Yes.
And, you know, his administration, and we can talk about what we hoped for and what we thought we were getting with him. But geez, the way our hopes have been dashed with this guy, and the banks have done real all right under his presidency. The top 10%, have done great. The professional class, in particular, the upper reaches of it, have done really, really well. And the people that used to be Democrats out in the country are just like they're watching their way of life crumble, and they know it's happening, and they're angry as hell. And we're now looking at. I mean, how many anger elections have we gone through now? But it's finally out in the open. It's in both parties. And there's no putting this, brushing this under the rug this year. I mean, I don't think that either Sanders or Trump is going to be president. But I think it'll probably be Hillary Clinton, who's sort of the candidate, the complacency candidate this year.
Well, yeah. I think that's probably a good prediction. But let me ask you if we're in a different time, because I mean, just as I was thinking about our talk here, today, I was trying to make that comparison of the time and the implications. I mean, one. Say what you will about Obama, to a large extent, although there was certainly, there was certainly an extended period of time during his administration, I would say, close to 5 years, where the idea of cutting Social Security was on the table.
Yeah.
During that time, I can't really point to, maybe on the civil liberties front, but in terms of like economic policy in this area that we're talking about specifically, I can't point to those five things that we could during Clinton that took place here.
No, that's right. His record is nowhere near as bad as Clinton's. I think Obama has been, it's been very frustrating, and it's been a great disappointment. Obama has, given what was possible in 2009.
Yes, yes. I think there's a deficit
between. That's the standard
between...
by which you have to measure him. But we know what Obama's achievements are. It's the stimulus, it's Dodd-Frank, and it's Obamacare. And that's pretty much it.
I mean, I think things like net neutrality is going to be pretty important actually going forward.
Oh, sure. Absolutely. But that's like, compared to these other things, that's very small.
Right, right.
I mean, I was for that. I was very happy with that when Obama came out on that. And but he's not going to get the Trans-Pacific Partnership through. You know, that's going to
Are you sure about that? I hope you're right. I have a feeling lame duck.
But I know it's going to. I'm not. Of course, I'm not sure. You know as much about D.C. as me, but I think that's going to be left over for another President Clinton.
I listen. As long as that stays in play, the better, I think, because if they take a vote at the lame duck, it becomes an issue. But I think by the time we get to, February 2017, there's going to be an extreme amount of pressure on the Democrats in the House not to vote for that. And I think by all accounts, if Hillary Clinton is the president, there's going to be a much smaller majority for the Republicans, and it's going to be even more dominated by that 40-person Freedom Caucus. And they're going to go from 1/6 of the 1/8 of the Republican caucus to closer to 1/6 of the Republican caucus, just because of the, and that's going to be very beneficial in terms of like stopping something like TPP. But staying on this point, like, do you think that we as on the left have a different awareness of what's going on, and that there is positives come out of it? Because I want to,
Listen, absolutely. This is the Great Recession changed everybody's way of thinking about the economy. I wrote a book years ago about the Clinton era. I mean, it wasn't about Clinton. It was about the economy. It was called One Market Under God, and it was about the bubble economy. And it's hard even now to remember the kind of optimism that people had back then.
The end of the 90s. That was it. That was...
In the 90s. And it's that attitude is so complete. It might as well be another country.
Yeah.
I mean, CNBC still exists, and it still runs those kind of TV commercials. But the optimism has completely drained out of the general public. People are so bitter and so cynical, believing the worst in all situations, and they can see that their lives are not coming back. We're talking about the kids getting out of college, the millennials who are entering this job market that is the gig economy, where good jobs have basically disappeared. For people their age, hell, for people my age, for everybody, it's an amazing thing what is happening now, and they're coming out with all of this, all of this debt into a world that wants to give them, basically the equivalent of working at Hardee's, and this is, people know this, they understand. I mean, they do these polls all the time and ask people if the recession is over. Like, it sounds like it's a question of fact. But people always, a majority of Americans say, no, the recession is not over. It's still going. It's been over for, 7 years now. And people think it's still going on. It's not working for the middle class anymore.
Right.
I mean, the middle class itself is declining, and people know it. Something is different this time around. It's not obvious, right? Because these are complicated things that we're talking about. They're difficult things. But both Bernie and Trump are talking in very blunt terms, blaming everything on trade, or blaming everything on the Wall Street banks. And people are excited to hear this kind of talk. That kind of moment.
Do you think, though, that this is, that we are better situated as a population to get, at the very least, the Democrats to respond to this regardless of who is president? I mean, because it seems to me that Sanders has already had the effect of pushing Hillary Clinton to the left. We are at a point.
Yeah.
What's amazing to me is that in the race for Senate in California, and this is true, I think, all across the country for the Democrats, that the idea of, anybody, any Democrat who signed on to Simpson Bowles, even spoke a word positive about this, is getting hammered right now on this. And
that
it is becoming.
I did not know that.
Oh, yeah. Kamala Harris is destroying, I think it's Loretta Sanchez, for her coming out and speaking nicely about Simpson Bowles in 2013. And we're seeing
that's
this.
Awesome.
Well, this is
that's
happening
awesome.
Across the country. And, you know, this guy, Tim Canova, who's taking on Debbie Wasserman Schultz in Florida right now. I mean, the guy's raising a tremendous amount of money. Zephyr Teachout raising a tremendous amount of money online for her race in the open 19th district in New York, which is a very important district in terms of, like, you know, Gillibrand came from that district. Chris Gibson is going to run for governor, a Republican, but he comes from that district. There just seems to me that there is increasing strength. You know, the idea that you have Senate candidates running in a primary who are out ahead, who are hammering their Democratic opponents in a primary for even thinking of cutting Social Security and not buying on to the idea of expanding it seems amazing to me in terms of a transformation.
Yeah, it is. We have turned a corner. Truly, we have turned a corner. I mean, that is great. And I think even Barack Obama seemed to change his tune quite a bit in the last couple of years. I mean, he seems like a very different man today than he was in 2009. I think he understands the Republicans better. I think he understands the job better. But when you mentioned Hillary Clinton moving to the left because of pressure from Sanders, that's going to evaporate as soon as he's out of the race. That will be gone. I think I know where Hillary Clinton's heart is, and she is exactly one of these professional class liberals that I describe in the book. I think she'll be a very competent president. She'll be good at the job, but I think she will be a president of complacency. You know, it'll be Obama's third term. Nothing will change. You know, you might even see something like her own version of a grand bargain. By the way, grand bargain is that when I heard that word, that was the moment when I knew that my love for Obama was over.
Yes.
You know, it was that I forget when it was. I was in a green room somewhere and someone was talking about Obama's search for the grand bargain. And I knew immediately what it meant, what he was after. And it was just like, oh, no, because then I understood. Up until then, I always, you know, there were two Obamas in 08. There was the bipartisan seeking Obama who always wanted consensus with the Republicans, and then there was the Obama who gave that great speech in New York about Wall Street and what had gone wrong in the financial crisis. Mm. And I thought that the latter Obama was the one I was voting for. I think most people did. And then I thought the other stuff, you know, all the stuff about bipartisan, reaching across the aisle and building consensus. I thought all that was just for show.
Right. That was our projection. I mean, I remember
exactly the other way around.
Exactly. I remember when the revelations, you know, the whole Reverend Wright was exposed, and I was like, yes, he is exactly who I thought he was. Thank God. And then I realized, like, over time, I realized, you know what? I actually believe. I don't even think he was ever sitting in the pew with. I don't think he ever heard anything, Reverend Wright. But I think there's a fundamental difference, because if Hillary Clinton ends up being the Democratic nominee, which is, statistically speaking,
it looks pretty likely.
It looks likely,
yeah.
but one doesn't know at this point, at least when we're recording this. But if that happens, my sense is that there isn't going to be that same sense within within the Democratic Party and to the left of the Democratic Party that she is that people are going to look to her for an agenda. I think there's going to be on day one. I think there's going to be a more active, and maybe again I'm just projecting and hopeful wishful thinking. There's going to be a more active attempt to push her in a way where I think people, you know, when people felt like, okay, mission accomplished, Barack Obama's the president, now everything's going to change. It took like 2 years before, you know, you started to see, Occupy Wall Street, maybe
yeah,
2.5 years,
right,
where you started to see like some semblance of like, hey, wait a second. Now, you know, different time, obviously there was a crisis, but I don't think there's going to be a huge cohort of people who are, you know, I got a tweet the other day And I was being attacked as some type of, because of my support for Bernie Sanders. And someone tweeted at me, look, he's pie in the sky. And I don't believe that education should be a universal right. One or two other points. Yeah. And I went to go check this person's bio. And I don't know if this is a real person or not. That's not the point. But they said, member of the Warren wing of the Democratic Party. And I just thought, like, have you not been listening to what Warren is saying? Like, I think there are reasons why people can be excited about Hillary Clinton, but one of them is not she's a huge, raging socialist liberal, right? Which is what you got about Obama. And
that's right.
I think those people who were saying that about Obama on day one, I don't think there's no logic that says that what they should do is disengage from politics. It's that they're going to be working harder on day one, which I think is going to be helpful. Maybe I'm projecting, but give me your sense of that before we go.
You're totally right about that. What I'm interested in listen, liberal are the people who do like Hillary, and why do they like Hillary? What is the appeal of Hillary Clinton? I mean, because she does have people who are very passionate about her. It's not all just Bernie Sanders. You know, she is winning somebody's vote. And so I went to a Hillary event. This is before she was had started her campaign for the presidency, and it was a Clinton Foundation event where she was the MC. And there's the whole event was all about professional achievement and women becoming CEOs of Fortune 500 companies, women being Army generals, women being in the diplomatic corps, basically that women should be represented in the highest, corners of American life. You know, that's great, and more power to them. It was fascinating, though. That's what it was about. It was about very high status women and women achieving very high status positions. It's never about, working class women. Sometimes they talk about getting equal pay, equal with men, but the idea of working class people in general getting, say, equal pay with their boss, that's just like, no way. No, that's like not even on the table. That's not even thinkable. Can I tell you a funny fact that I uncovered while I was writing this?
Please.
So there's, while I was writing Listen Liberal, I went to Decatur, Illinois, which was a scene that was important to me as a young man. One of my first pieces of journalism that I ever wrote was about a strike in Decatur. It was actually three strikes going at the same time in this small town in southern Illinois. And the strikers, the workers had radicalized themselves, and it was fascinating. You know, all of these are people that you generally don't think of as being radical, not even liberal, right? And they sure were, man. Anyhow, it was an interesting story, and so I went back there to see what Decatur looks like today, and it looks like exactly what you would expect. You know, it's ruination for a lot of people. And you can look up what has happened with the, when this strike was going on, the strikers used to always talk about how they were fighting for the middle class, and the middle class was dying in this country and this kind of stuff. And they turned out to be, totally correct about all that. And I also got some data on Decatur from the 1940s. Now, this will blow your mind. So I looked up what the CEOs of two of the big companies there are, like Caterpillar and Archer Daniels Midland. And of course, they earn something like 500 times as much as average workers, which is very typical nowadays, or 300 times or something like that. This enormous multiple, right? But then I went back to the 1940s, and it turned out famous sociologist did a study of Decatur right after World War II. And the bosses at these firms back then made two times as much as their workers. Two times. This is in like 46. Isn't that amazing? It just blows your mind.
I mean, I contend that is that dynamic. I mean, it's is a huge factor in all of this. And there's some great research by a professor out of UMass. And I don't know how his name escapes me at the moment. We've had him on a couple of times, but he really tracks a lot of the wealth inequality to the way CEOs and board of directors.
Is it Robert Frank? Is that this guy?
No, it's
It doesn't matter. I know exactly what you're talking about.
People can look back, and I mention it all the time on the program. But dealing with the idea of stock options and capital gains taxes becoming sort of like where you have essentially businesses run as sort of side cottage industries, where it's not about the products you're making or future planning. It is all about your stock prices and
getting that bonus. Yes, that's exactly right. That, by the way, that is another story of the 1990s. That is really the story of the night. That didn't exist in the 80s. That all happened in the 90s when the people started getting paid in stock options. And I forget what it was, some technicality, and Robert Reich has talked about this. It was some sort of oversight or technical mistake that the Clinton administration made.
Well, my understanding from it's Bill Lozonik, actually, is the guy from UMass, and it was changes in the tax code in the mid to early 80s
is that right?
That began to promote this idea of stock options. And there may have been tweaks to it, but that is where he has tracked this to. Bill Lozonik, it's really fascinating stuff.
Yeah.
But regardless, from a political standpoint, it is there really does seem to be an awakening that is fundamentally different. And there's for the first time in my life, I think. A legitimate sort of clear-eyed vision of who the Democratic president is from Democrats early on, I think. I think that's going to be very helpful.
Yeah, I think that's right. I agree with you. I don't think Hillary is fooling anyone into thinking that she's some kind of radical. I'm sure the Republicans will call her that.
Yes.
How do you think they'll go at her this fall, I wonder? We know, right? It'll be all the emails and Benghazi, right?
Which actually I think is going to be, which is telling in and of itself too. I mean, they have exhausted the Manchurian Marxist thing. I mean, and obviously it wouldn't work with her. She's been around for 30 years. It's sort of hard to say that she's not an American citizen at this point. But
she was on the Walmart board, for God's sake.
I think they're going to go full on with the email thing, and I think that's going to be much to the benefit of the country, to be honest with you, because they're going to pursue this. And if they don't, you know, there's going to be House investigations, but they've sort of already been there, for the past 4 years. And so they're going to be living in their own little world. And I think they're going to cede the rest of the playing field for the relatively sane. That's my hope. But I guess that will be maybe the next book. Thomas Frank, the book is Listen, Liberal. Or Whatever Happened to the Party of the People. Thanks so much for your time today. We will put a link to your book at majority.fm, and always a pleasure.
Cool. Well, thank you, Sam. It was fun, as usual.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm going to get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught. The truth and the life fall. Finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining bright. I get somewhere the choice is made, for the option where you don't get paid. Breaks you. I guess somehow I lost my drive.